Today at Reader's Corner, Sonar Chaptai, author of The New Sultan, Erdogan and the Crisis of Modern Turkey. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Today's guest, Sonar Chaptai, is an expert on a country that many of us know too little about. That country is Turkey, the oldest democracy and the largest economy between India and Italy. Turkey occupies a crucial position in Europe, the Middle East, and Central Asia, and that makes its leader, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, a vitally important figure on the world stage. Last Sunday, in elections described as among the most momentous in modern Turkish history, Erdogan tightened his grip on power. He won the election outright, earning 5 more years in office, as well as vast new presidential powers. But while his strongman approach resonated with a slim majority of voters, his critics are sounding alarms that Turkey's democracy is imperiled. Today we'll talk about the election, as well as Erdogan's rise to power, with Dr. Chaptai. He is the author of a recent and very timely book titled The New Sultan, Erdogan and the Crisis of Modern Turkey. Dr. Chaptai is the Beyer Family Fellow and Director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He has written extensively on U.S.-Turkish relations in scholarly journals and for many major media outlets. He joins us today by Skype from Washington, D.C. Sonar Chaptai, welcome to Reader's Corner.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for hosting me.
Well, let's begin with this election. I must say the turnout was stunning. If I get this right, 90% of the Turkish voters showed up at the polls or voted absentee if they were expats living in Germany or France or wherever.
Is very that close to that. In fact, 87%. The Turks love to vote. Typically, this is a country where turnout is around 80%. But even by Turkish standards, this was high, almost a record not seen in decades. Nearly 9 out of 10 citizens voted. It shows us two things about Turkey. One is that the Turks love to vote. And of course, second is deeper. It shows the depth of democratic traditions in Turkey, that despite Erdogan's rise, we should never underestimate the country's democratic traditions. Turkey has been having free and fair elections since 1950, longer than has had Spain, a great country. But nevertheless, Turkey's traditions are 70-year-old. And I think regardless of what happens and transpires, there's always a hope that a country with nearly a century of democratic traditions will ultimately come out fine.
Let's move on to your book. I want to start with the first chapter where you lay out 3 possible options on where Turkey goes from here. Number 1, continued polarizing politics. Number 2, completely authoritarian regime. Or 3, civil war. Now, you wrote your book, of course, a good year or so before this election we just experienced. And I wanted your thoughts on, now that the election is behind us and you know what you do about that election, which of those 3 paths are most likely to present themselves?
Fortunately, for the sake of the book, but unfortunately for Turkey, the new Sultan is still quite relevant because it highlights this very deep political crisis that Turkey is in. And it says that the crisis is a direct result of the trajectory of the political trajectory of the country's leaders. That is Mr. Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Oftentimes, we think of Turkey as a country that follows trends invented in Europe and the West, because that's what the Turks have been doing for the last 300 years. The Ottoman Empire westernized, then Mustafa Kemal Atatürk established modern Turkey in 1923 out of the ashes of the Ottoman Empire. He continued to westernize and follow European statecraft and trends. And I would say that Mr. Erdogan represents an exception to this trend. This time the Turks are not following a trend invented elsewhere. They are actually inventors of the trend, and Mr. Erdogan is a prototype of populist leaders globally. He came to power in 2002. He delivered phenomenal economic growth and has built a base that loves him. That's a base that's constituted mostly by conservatives who adore him, including many people he has lifted out of poverty, and that's Erdogan's bright side. And that base thinks he can do nothing wrong. But Erdogan, as a populist politician, also has a dark side. He has demonized, cracked down on, and brutalized demographics that are not likely to vote for him. That includes many groups, including leftists and liberals, and Alevis, who are liberal Muslims, and they oppose him. And when you add these groups up, you get nearly half of Turkey, and they simply loathe him and think nothing good can come from him because he has both demonized and brutalized them in the last decade and a half. That is Turkey's crisis that I highlight in The New Sultan, that the country of 80 million people, the biggest democracy and economy between Italy and India, is now thrown into a deep crisis because of the trajectory that its leader has picked. I think that of the scenarios that I highlight in my book, I would say that Turkey is still mired in that deep crisis. And unfortunately, the election outcome has not resolved the crisis. Yes, Mr. Erdogan won again, but he won by a narrow margin, 2%, and he faces a very large opposition. Turks who haven't voted for him would constitute 40 million people. That is demographically and economically the size of Spain. They will not go away. But Mr. Erdogan has an agenda that he wants to shape Turkey in his own image as a populist and authoritarian leader. He's conservative, socially that is. Politically, he is Islamist. We're not saying he's a Muslim. He's using religion for politics. That makes him political Islamist. Not talking about his faith, his political beliefs. Third, he is also directionally someone who wants to take Turkey away from Europe and into the Middle East. Mm-hmm. That agenda is shared by his base, but the other half of the country will never fold under him. And I think that's Turkey's crisis, that he wants everybody to think, walk, and act like him, and half of the country will never accept that. Now, the election has not resolved that deep crisis because he's won by a narrow margin of victory, but he has recently changed the constitution in 2017, just as the new Sultan was being published. He actually became sort of the new Sultan with this constitutional amendment. The amendment makes him executive-style president. He is now head of state, head of government, head of ruling party, head of the police, which is a national force in Turkey, head of the military. He also has a right to appoint a majority of judges to the high courts. And following his election victory, he has executive and legislative branches in hand. So he's the most powerful elected politician Turkey has seen. But his mandate is embraced by only half of the country and rejected by the other half. And that is exactly the crisis that Mr. Erdogan's political trajectory has thrown into, from which, unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be any graceful exit for Turkey right at the moment.
In 2016, there was a failed military coup, and obviously Erdogan came down pretty hard on the military. Now that he's been reelected with these new presidential powers, is it safe to say there won't be any coup attempt on Erdogan's regime?
So the coup attempt was a botched coup, and it was not a coup against the government, but it was a faction within the military that tried to overthrow the rest of the military and the government, which is why it was quickly put down. And Mr. Erdogan rightfully put in place a state of emergency after the coup, but he has since extended that state of emergency 7 times. And in fact, the last elections on Sunday, where he won a narrow victory by a narrow margin, were held under a state of emergency. So it's hard to say that the race was fair because the government had resources in its favor lined up. And not only that, pro-government businesses, not only that, they control over 90% of the media. The government can censor online content. There was a state of emergency which gave the police to arrest citizens and curb liberties. Police that is controlled by the national government. And so it's hard to speak of fair elections. Now, in my view, the vote was fair, which is a very good sign. So the day of the voting, there was no intimidation. Everybody cast their ballots freely. And that shows to us the depth of Turkey's democratic traditions. And while we're having this sort of depressing conversation on Turkey and rise of populist leaders in Turkey and in Europe, nice takeaway is that Turkey still remains deeply democratic because of the very fair nature of the vote, even following this unfair campaign. But clearly, Mr. Erdogan's challenges are no more from the military. I think his challenge is really from this half of the country that does not subscribe to his agenda and will not fold under him. I sometimes wish that he would embrace that other half and realize that they're not a threat, but maybe it's too hard for him to do that. He has demonized so many opposition groups, brutalized so many demographics, and remember that some people he arrested on various charges have died in jail while they're waiting to see a judge. Mr. Erdogan knows that he almost certainly faces prosecution if he ever loses the elections, which is why I think losing is not an option. He's got to win and win going forward. And that only suggests that if you think like him, you ought to be more authoritarian going forward because you got a really thin majority that has elected you, 52 versus 48, that could slip away from your fingers. So if you see him becoming more authoritarian going forward, it's not because he's irrational. It's because, to the contrary, he's rational. He's trying to prevent being voted out, and he knows that when left to its democratic devices, the Turkish society might vote him out. So he will unfortunately become more authoritarian going forward. That will only anger and alienate the opposition further, and therefore exacerbate the country's crisis that his political trajectory has created in the first place.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Soner Çaptay, author of The New Sultan. The book examines Turkey's political history and the rise of power of its president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Now, President Erdogan's leading opposition candidate garnered 30% of the vote, which is a pretty impressive number for Social Democrats. I think that's a record in Turkish history. And he immediately called the election unfair, or maybe to get more precise about it, he may have been referring to events leading up to the election, because I think you touched on this, but I'd like you to address the opposition candidate's access to the media. I thought what I heard him saying was that he simply wasn't allowed TV as Erdogan was. Can you help us understand how that works?
Absolutely. Great question. Clearly, this was not a fair campaign. A government not only has publicly funded media that Mr. Erdogan's government controls, but also private media is almost entirely in the hands of pro-government businesses. And that was not the case when Mr. Erdogan came to power. As a populist leader, what he made sure after he came to power that using loopholes, targeted political tax audits, he forced media, critical of him, to sell media outlets that they control to businesses that are friendly to him. And that's a textbook case from the, let's say, the worksheets of many other authoritarian leaders, from Vladimir Putin to Viktor Orban in Hungary. In this regard, I think Turkey is following some East European trends. And as a result, Turkey's media is almost completely owned by pro-government businesses. So the opposition had almost no access to the media. Of course, they could use social media, but even there, the government can censor online content. Despite that, main opposition candidate, Muharrem İnce, did quite well. It's a record for Turkey's left or social democrats in nearly three decades since early 1990s. The last time they reached the 30% mark was back then. And I think this is quite impressive. For a very long time, it was said that in addition to his bright side, delivering phenomenal economic growth and improving incomes, and his dark side, demonizing and cracking down his opponents, Mr. Erdogan had a third reason that explained his success. He was blessed with an ineffective and divided opposition. I think that's no more the case. The opposition not only came together to stage a unified race against him, but they've also produced some really competent candidates. Mr. İnce is one of them. And what is unique about him is that he is cut from the same cloth as Mr. Erdogan is. What I mean by that is the following. Mr. Erdogan's strength in Turkish politics as a populist politician, as I write in my book, The New Sultan, is that he casts himself as the guy from the other side of the tracks, so that he becomes relatable to the common man. Clearly, he's not the guy from the other side of the tracks. He's Turkey's most powerful politician. He's ran the country for nearly two decades. He's head of state, head of government, head of military, head of police, head of ruling party. His business interests, or those of his family, are in millions and maybe billions. So quite wealthy and powerful. But his image is that of the underdog. He casts himself as the guy from the other side of the tracks. And that's extremely relatable for the common man. And that's what makes him elected over and over again. Mr. İnce is the first opposition candidate who's challenged Mr. Erdogan, Turkey's president, in the last 16 years since Erdogan became prime minister and then president and took power in Turkey. Mr. İnce is the first politician who challenges Erdogan, and he too looks like he's the guy from the other side of the tracks. So I think going forward, he's going to be a challenge to Mr. Erdogan, and that's one positive takeaway of the election, that maybe the opposition is now producing competent candidates that can balance him out. In this regard, a second candidate is Mrs. Akşener. She comes from Turkey's political right, set up a party, and her party was able to receive nearly 10% of the vote. Quite impressive. It was a startup. And this is the first time that a woman in Turkey has set up a party, and the party has been able to enter politics and become a player in terms of gender issues. That's a very positive development. She, too, is quite competent, and she, too, will challenge Mr. Erdogan. So it's not going to be an easy ride. It's not going to be a walk in the park for Mr. Erdogan going forward.
And could you comment on the Kurdistan Workers' Party? They were predicted to get the 10%, and I think they did, so they'll have a seat in parliament as well. Is that correct?
not the Kurdistan Workers Party, but I think you mean People's Democracy Party.
Yes, called that's
AKP.
Right. Yes.
This is a Kurdish nationalist party.
Yes.
That typically received just about 6-7% of the vote. The HDP is an interesting phenomena. So Turkey has a quite high electoral threshold at about 10%. It's a multi-party democracy. There are more than two parties running. And so in multi-party democracies, when you have a dozen or more parties running, if every party gets into the parliament, the vote is so split, no party can have majority or form government. So typically, multi-party democracies institute what is called an electoral threshold. They require that parties cross a certain number, a threshold, before they can be represented in the parliament. So it cuts out minor parties from the race and allows some kind of a political consolidation in the legislature. Most countries have a threshold of 2.5%. Some countries which have troublesome parties, such as the Nazis in Germany, have 5%, because in Germany, the Nazi or the neo-Nazi parties typically poll around 4%. So the 5% threshold, relatively high, cups them out. Turkey's threshold is one of the highest in any democratic country, 10%. This threshold typically cut out Kurdish nationalist parties who polled around 6 and 7%. But the party's leadership has done something really interesting. And that party, while it's on the left and being Kurdish nationalist, has a charismatic leader. His name is Mr. Demirtas. He broadened the party's narrow Kurdish national appeal, and he included many liberals on his list, so that his list was half women, included members of Turkey's ethnic and political minorities, Christians and Armenians, and openly gay candidates. That helped broaden his appeal, and his party went from being a small one to one that crossed Turkey's 10% threshold, and he reached well above 11%. So he's also in the parliament and his party. And I think another positive takeaway of this conversation about where Turkey goes, while overall trajectory doesn't seem very positive, unfortunately, under Mr. Erdogan's authoritarian and grip, is that the elections have also produced probably one of the most diverse parliaments in Turkey's history. Every political party, significant movement is represented. So I think it's going to be interesting to watch the debate. Although the parliament will be under Mr. Erdogan, he will face significant opposition from his opponents, who, after all, will be holding just about 250 seats versus his 350 seats.
I have to ask one question about President Erdogan that I think I know the answer to. But one of the things that I learned in your book, The New Sultan, was a relatively minor detail in the overall scheme of your book. In 1998, when I believe he was assuming office, he had to wait 5 months to assume that office because he was actually in jail for reciting a religious poem. And
that's correct.
Is that correct? I mean, that just comes as such a shock. You know, those of us in America are looking to Turkey to expand its secular image in the world and in its own country, and yet secularism, if it's defined as freezing out the ability of an individual to recite an Islamic poem or a religious poem, whatever religion right. It is, you really have to wonder, maybe it explains why a guy like Erdogan makes this move to the right after being treated as such, and you might want to explain that for us. And I guess the question is there any chance that now that he has all this presidential power and he's in control, that he could veer back to the middle instead of the right?
Let's look at the first part of your question, understanding him and where he's coming from. As I explained in The New Sultan, Mr. Erdogan was born in 1954 to a working-class family in a poor district of Istanbul. His parents were conservative. They wanted to wear religion on their sleeve. At that time, Turkey had a secularist form of political system and government, which treated people who wore religion on their sleeves as second-class citizens. Growing up in Turkey, Mr. Erdogan felt completely and fundamentally othered. And I think as he joined political movements, he built a grudge against the system that treated people like him, that were mostly poor and pious, as not first-class citizens. That is where he's coming from, and I think that explains some of the anger he has against the system. But as I write in my book, what is important is that this guy from the other side of the tracks has now crossed to this side of the tracks. He is Turkey's most powerful politician. His party has been in charge for 20 years. Turkey is, unfortunately and ironically, gone from being a country that treated pious people as second class to a country that treats non-pious people as second class. So he hasn't made Turkey more equal for everybody. He's made it equal for his base while making it less equal for his opponents. And so in a way today, Turkey is perhaps even less free because those who are not pious and don't want to wear religion on their sleeve but are pious but don't want to make it a political issue feel that the government discriminates against them. And I think that's Mr. Erdogan's challenge. I think Turkey has a way going forward. Clearly, it will be a case, a country that's predominantly Muslim, that is, that's also democratic, that can bring its disparate halves together. Turkey has two halves, a half that loves Mr. Erdogan and is conservative, and a half that loathes him and is not conservative, mostly constituted by leftists and liberals. They can live together, I believe, and this goes through a simple amendment to the Constitution, which should say that Turkey will provide simultaneously, the state that is, will provide and guarantee freedom of religion for the pious half and freedom from religion for the secular non-pious half. It will be that simple to bring the country's disparate halves together and to let them know that they're both welcome in this country. After all, that is the only solution in my view, because both of these blocks that oppose each other, the pious and the secular, are about equally the same size, 40 million people. Demographically and economically, they're about the same size. So even if one wishes the other one is not going to disappear or go away. And I wish Mr. Erdogan embraced that, because then he would go down in history not only as the guy who made Turkey wealthy, and that's where he deserves credit, but also as the guy who launched Turkey on the way to greatness by bringing a new constitution. So far, I'm not holding my breath, because I think his brand of polarizing in order to win elections precludes a idea that he would reach across the aisle and bring the rest of the country under his tent as a president, because he wins elections not just by delivering growth, but also demonizing those that are unlikely to vote for him so that his base keeps consolidating around him. And that has that winning formula has awarded him many, many victories. And I would love to see him diverge from it and stay away from it. But even in the aftermath of the election, that doesn't seem to be likely.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Soner Çaptay, author of The New Sultan, Erdogan and the Crisis of Modern Turkey. Let's talk about the impact of this election on the rest of the world. One of the first people, I believe, to congratulate Mr. Erdogan was Russia's Putin. Tell us about the relationship that Erdogan has had with Putin, and is it at all likely to change in any way?
Clearly, Mr. Putin and Mr. Erdogan have an affinity for each other in their style of governance. But I think analogies of Turkey and Russia are a little bit far stretched. I think while the two leaders have affinity in the style that they govern, they have brought media under their control. Turkey is not Russia. What do I mean by that is the following. Turkey has been having free and fair elections for 70 years. Russia's election or free elections are less than a decade or so after the end of the Cold War, and then they ended with the rise of Mr. Putin. So it's easier to rig, to have a complete unfair, unfree vote in Russia. That's not something you can do in Turkey. And the proof of that is in Russia, Mr. Putin wins with as much as 60-70% solid majorities. Now remember that Mr. Erdogan and Mr. Putin came to power just about the same time, beginning of the last decade. They have been in power about the same length of time. They both have a tight grip on their societies. And yet look at Russia, where Putin wins with nearly 70%. And look at Turkey, where Erdogan barely crosses 50%. So I think despite their similarities, because Turkey and Russia are structurally different, Turkey will remain more deeply democratic and, more importantly, more deeply pluralistic going forward.
One of the speeches that Mr. Erdogan gave after his election said something like, Turkey will liberate Syrian lands. What impact does this election have on the Syrian conflict?
Clearly, Mr. Erdogan's agenda in Syria to undermine and oust the regime of Assad has failed. That's because he's been confronted in Syria by two powerful regional and global players, that is Iran and Russia, both of which support the Assad regime. Iran has proxies, including Hezbollah from Lebanon, that has nearly 30,000 well-trained, well-armed guerrilla fighters. Turkey's proxies are just a couple of thousand people who usually fight among themselves more than they fight the Assad regime. And Russia is a more important contender that has checked Turkey's ambitions in Syria. Russia has, of course, a nuclear arsenal, which Turkey doesn't have, and therefore Turkey feels threatened by Russia, which is also a historic nemesis. And the Russians, of course, have veto power at the UN Security Council, which means that there can never be international action sanctioned by the UN to oust the regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. So I think Turkey's Syria policy meant well. It meant to end Assad's brutal crackdown. But at the same time, I should add that it was ill-executed and ill-conceived because it confronted Iran and Russia without backing or without securing concrete and long-term U.S. backing to that end, whether it was with President Obama or with President Trump. No U.S. president has committed to Turkey's policy of ousting Assad so directly and so forcefully. And I think that's where he's failed to appreciate that Washington was never completely behind him. The policy has left him exposed to Russian and Iranian pushback. So I would say liberating Syria for him is not a realistic goal. I think only one issue remains, that Turkey has nearly 3.5 million refugees from Syria. That's a very big number in a country of 80 million people, almost 5% of the population. And so the question is, what happens with the refugees? There's a growing a movement in Turkey against them, although Turkey has hosted these refugees, providing them with safe haven and generously so, with little international assistance, taking care of nearly 3.5 million people. There's also public resentment, and I think he has to deal with the rising resentment as well. So I would say Syria is an issue where he's going to have some troubles and problems coming up.
You close your book, The New Sultan, by hoping, let's put it that way, that the economy of Turkey could turn from just exporting automobiles to software and information technology. Could you comment, please, Soner, on how Mr. Erdogan's election is likely to affect Turkey's troubled economy, in particular in the area of foreign investment?
So I argue in The New Sultan that I believe that Mr. Erdogan wants to make Turkey great. That's his agenda. As a populist leader, part of his appeal is that he's convinced his base that he's going to make Turkey a powerful country. And I think he's made some good strides to that end because he has lifted many people out of poverty. When he came to power in 2002, a factor that I love most from the new sultan is that he inherited a country in which infant mortality rate was comparable to pre-war Syria. That is pre-war Syria, not today, of course. Now, Turkey's infant mortality rate is comparable to Spain. But Turkey still has a way to go. It's not by any means an advanced economy. It is what is called a middle-income economy. It's no more poor, thanks to Mr. Erdogan, but it has not become rich as well. It's in the middle. And its main exports, as most countries in the middle, as the case for most countries in the middle, is cars. So symbolically, I write in my book that if Turkey has to become an advanced economy, its main exports should go from being cars to becoming software and IT. That when Turkey becomes a hub for Google, then it has become an advanced economy. And it can do that, but probably not under Mr. Erdogan, because he's curbed liberties, cracked down on freedoms of expression, association, media, and assembly to such an extent that most educated Turks do not want to stay in Turkey. There's already worrying signs of a brain drain. And not only that, but for countries to make that jump to become advanced economies, I believe they not only have to keep talent, but they have to attract talent. That's not happening today. You're not seeing people rushing to visit Turkey because of the image of the country that has been tarnished as a result of both the coup, a nefarious plot, but also Mr. Erdogan's authoritarian grip. And I think he will have problems retaining capital and talent and attracting capital and talent if Turkey does not become an open and democratic society. But I argue in The New Sultan that Mr. Erdogan cannot afford a fully open democratic society because then he fears he'll be voted out. So it's almost as if he's stuck between a hammer and a hard place. Can make Turkey great if Turkey becomes open and democratic, but if Turkey becomes open and democratic, he'll be voted out. I think that, therefore, he will not go down in history as the guy who carried out that wonderful and much-needed political transformation in Turkey.
We've just about to have to wrap it up, Soner, but I have to tell you, this has been a great opportunity to capitalize on the election and talk about the future of Turkey. I feel like we didn't get into some of the history of Turkey, which you cover in your book, and I would urge our listeners, if they're interested in this subject, this is the book you want to get. It's called The New Sultan, Erdogan and the Crisis of Modern Turkey by Soner Çaptay. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, and you're all welcome to visit my book's website at newsultan.info, and thanks for hosting me. I really appreciate it. It was a great pleasure to join you.
Next week, Wade Davis, author of Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sienna Madrid. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.